have examined the use of free will and looked at some of its parameters, the limitations, applications. Now we want to tonight go into the source in the neshama. We want to descend right into the root of the neshama. We want to look at the machine that powers Bechira, the concept called the Das, and we want to have a look tonight at that concept and try and examine it. Now the facts that we need to know as follows. We also, if anybody felt that they've been through this discussion and had enough of it, you've heard maybe in our groups before, you're also welcome to leave another comment. Now, the Das is the most difficult area to talk about. Okay, it's the center of the neshama, it's the tool of transcendence, it's the means by which a person can become, can transcend beyond who he is. It's the only tool by which God knowledge can be achieved. Yes, it's the only point of connection, the only means of connecting with any transcendent knowledge. It's the marriage, it's the power behind the marriage. The only way a person can bond with a woman is through the Das. It's the only way a person can achieve knowledge of anything is through a unity called the Das. It's the most important subject you've ever heard of. You never heard anything in your life yet as important as what we're going to say now. And it's the most difficult to say, because it cannot be put into words. And the Das, or if you ask questions now, for sure it's not going to happen. Wait until
I
finish.
I'm
about to explain it.
Okay,
how to explain it? Dalit Ayin. Now, we're going to, please, I would appreciate that you hold the questions tonight, because I have to put together a picture of something that's impossible to put in words. So you must have a lot of questions. So don't ask any of them. Wait till we have built something of a framework, and then, all right, we'll try and leave time. If not, then we'll continue the discussion. It needs many, many hours of thought. If you think you understand what we're talking about, anybody, any among us think that what we're going to say now is understood, then for sure you've missed it. Okay, for sure. That you can, that's only a point of certainty out of here. Alright? However, there is a very, very intimate point of connection with experience here. And if that comes alive, then that's the first step. Now, we'll try and talk a little bit about it and see. The main difficulty here is that the Das is an experience of transcendence, which is so deep that by definition it can never be put into words. We're going to try and explain it a little bit, but you realize that the exercise is futile from the beginning. However, we talk about it for a certain reason. We talk about it for a very constructive and specific reason, and that is because there is a phenomenon in human experience which is as follows. That there are many things that cannot be put into words, but you can talk about them closely enough to cause the listener to fall into it by accident. In other words, you can bring it to the brink with words, point the direction, and if you trip and fall in, then suddenly the lights come on and you don't need any words. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. But it's only by individual work that the thing can come alive. Alright? The words we're going to say now are only just a pointing of the direction very, very, very vaguely. Okay, it cannot be said any clearer than this. I mean, certainly can't be said definitively. So let's have a look for a moment. Now, let's look at it this way. You see, the word Das means knowledge, but the English word, as useless as usual, is prostituted to the point of uselessness. I mean, the word knowledge is irrelevant here. Yeah, but if you want some English word to hang it on, you can use that. But we try not to use English word. It's just a connotations which are completely misleading. Das means one of its ramifications is knowledge, but it has many other meanings. It means sexual union, marriage. Means marriage, specifically physical closeness. It means procreation. Right? Das is intimately bound up with the potential to produce offspring. It is the bond of souls that happens in a marriage. It is a core line that runs through the human being from the place of the tefillin, right? The fontanelle where the baby's skull is open, you can always say. Through that line and beyond, to an infinite distance, into the soul, between the male and female halves of the brain, through the heart, through the organs of speech, the lashon, which is called the bris, and through the bris milah. Yes, through the circumcision. That's the axis of the Das. And in many, each part of that axis has a focus which has a special name and can be studied independently. But this axis is a very, very indefinable thing, and You know that we discussed already some of the points, the 10 points that make up any structure in the universe. We discussed some of them already, yes? 3 of them in the mind, 7 in the body, that make a picture of anything that exists. The dust isn't even one of those, according to my opinion. It's a force that bonds them together. If you like, the closest I can say without using forbidden terms is that the 10 points that we talk about are the anatomy of any structure in the universe. The dance is the physiology. It's the way they flow together. It's one of the mechanisms, one of the axes that bonds all these units together to form a function. Try and talk about it a bit more and see what I mean. Let's change gear for a moment. Look at it from another point of view. We do not think that anything we say is going to explain it, okay? We're just going to walk around it until we've defined what it's not, maybe, carefully enough so that you can maybe by accident fall into it. One step at a time. One of the classical expressions of the Dasa is as follows. Here comes probably the most important expression of this idea, the most practical and most important. Now, express it like this. A person is considered to have two eyes, an inner eye and an outer eye. That's called the Mabata Pnimi and the Mabata Chitsoni. Now, these two eyes work as follows. We're going to talk a lot now about the external eye because it can be put into words easily. But it's only for the purpose of understanding the one that it's not, the inner eye, which cannot be put into words. Are we clear? So we'll start talking about the outer eye. It's familiar to you, and it doesn't need much explanation. But try and maintain a very sharp definition of what it is so that when we focus inwards, we can be very, very careful not to mix the two. The biggest temptation and the biggest mistake is to look inwardly with the outer eye. And then you're lost completely. Alright? Now, let's look at it this way. The outer eye is defined as follows. The mabata chitsoni, that means the outward look, the looking outward of a human, is defined as follows. It is all functions of the neshama, which have sense organs, organs of interface with the world, including the object of logical faculty. Alright? Again, the mabata chitsoni is all your interface with the world, what you feel, what you can see, what you can prove to yourself, proved by sense organs or by logic. You understand? It's an objective faculty, and its basis in Torah is called emes. It's truth. As opposed to emuna. Emuna is what we translate very, very crudely in English as faith or belief, which it doesn't mean at all. But it's that axis, and that is related to the internal eye. The external eye is the focus of something called emes. Emes is truth, which means it forces itself upon you. I'm not talking about somebody who's not willing to be logical. If you're not willing to be logical, then you can't begin. There's no discussion. You understand? If a person is not prepared to think logically, put his emotions aside and think logically, they don't have any discussion. But somebody's prepared to think logically, the logic, the emes of his logical process overcomes the emotion. No question. You can't say you don't want to believe it. Emes is emes. It forces itself on you. Now, this outward look functions as follows. One and one is two is a function of the mother's concern. And a person has a grasp of the fact that one and one equals two, that's purely a faculty and a function of the external eye. Is that clear? When a person has a grasp of something that exists in front of him, black and white or in three-dimensional structure, because he can see it, feel it, taste it, experience it, you understand? It's also with its external faculty. So it's how we interface with the world, and it's how we interpret the world in a logical computer-type sense. Okay? That's called the... Now, here comes the next most important point. The Mabata Chitsoni, this outward look, has one tremendous limitation, one definitive limitation. It can never look inward. The classical thinkers in this area put it this way. They say that the Mabata Chitsoni is like a camera. The camera can take a picture of anything in the world except one thing. The camera. The only way, if you're clever, you can get a camera to take a picture of a reflection of itself, which is a technique that's used in this field. But you can never get it to take a picture of itself unless you smash it. To turn it inward, it has to break. Now, the Mabata Chitsoni that looks outward can never look at the core. It can never look inward at the questions that the dais handles. Because by definition, it has to be broken to do that. Now, hold that in your mind for a moment, and let's talk about the inward, what we can say about the inner eye. And it should become clearer. Not clear, but hopefully a little clearer. The Mabata Pnimi, the look that looks inward, has the following characteristics. Can never be expressed in words, can never be proven to anybody else, yes? Can never be proven to anybody else, which means, can never be proven to yourself by objective terms. If it could be proven to yourself in objective mathematical logical terms, you could prove it to somebody else too. But it cannot be done that way. Which means that you can never get in touch with it through the external eye. Trying to look inward with the external eye is doomed to failure, can never be done. Frustration, only a frustrating experience, leads to depression, all kind of things. Now, the only way we can really deal with this is by using the dye. I can't explain it because I can't be put into words and I can't show it to you. But we can give an example that everybody's had, an experience. If you've had this experience and you can look into it, then you understand what the dice is and doesn't need to be proved. Because a dice experience is more real and more proved than an objective experience. More real and more proven, although you cannot put it into objective mathematical terms. Let me give you an example. Many examples, and they're the most important parts of being alive. But let's use one or two examples and try and get a handle on this thing. The most critical area in which the dice functions, and all other applications of the dice are branches of this concept, you have to hear this very well, is a grasp of my own existence. That's the prime and fundamental function of the dice. The dice grasps that I am. Now, let's see if it checks out with the definitions that we mentioned. Can never be proven? Absolutely. You know that one can never prove one's own existence. That's the fundamental problem of philosophy. Right? All secular philosophical systems set out to first define how we can prove that we exist. Descartes' famous, I think, therefore I am, is a solution to this problem. We have to discuss what he meant by that. He isn't describing a dice function. We'll try and get to that if we can. Why can you never prove that you exist? It's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Here you're sending people to the moon and doing all kinds of things and you're not sure you're around. That's very embarrassing. Yes? Why is that? Because the only thing you're prepared to accept as proof is objective type proof, mathematical, external, logical type proof, sense organ type experiential proof, or one and one is two type proof. And the dice is not amenable to that type proof. Which means by definition you can never prove it. By definition you can never prove it. It reminds me, a friend of mine told me that there was a philosophy class and the lecturer tried to explain to the students that there's no way to prove that you exist. And one of the students, a very sensitive type, was very worried about it. He had a lot of doubt about his own existence. And he really couldn't come up with an answer, and he struggled and agonized for a week. What? After a week, he rushed up to the lecturer in tremendous anxiety and said to him, tell me, do I exist? The lecturer said to him, who wants to know? Okay, now. Now, okay, like this. Now, a person's faced with the following problem. Okay, this thing exists in front of me because I have criteria. If I make certain assumptions, then I have certain ways of reading the existence of this thing and I can prove it to myself within certain parameters. But whether anything exists, namely, and the most important part of that question is whether I exist. Really, that's the beginning of it. Actually, emunah is only a function of that, but we'll try and... It's an outgrowth of that, but we'll try and get there also. That question you can never answer. You can prove that you exist to me, to my objective faculty. That's not a problem. I can see that you exist on my objective criteria, my senses that I can feel, see, touch, taste, etc., and work out what I want to do. But that's not my sharing of your experience of existence. You follow? You cannot convey to me your diet, your knowledge of your own existence. You follow what I'm saying? And similarly, I to myself cannot conceptualize my own existence in objective terms. There's no way I can get a handle on it. Now, the problem that this has raised is that secular philosophical systems try to grapple with the problem of my own existence, and they try to come up with a theoretical model which proves to me that I exist, and by definition can never be done. Eastern philosophy is not bothered by this problem. Yes, it's a Western culture which, in this particular area, descended from Greek thinking, which the Greek attitude to the world was to relate only to what I can see and experience directly. That was what the Greeks thought. What I can measure and quantify and see and relate to scientifically, objectively, mathematically, that exists. Anything beyond that is a question. I'm not prepared to relate to that. I don't say it doesn't exist. But that doesn't interest me at the moment. Eastern thinking is completely different. We use words in the West like intuitive and internal and so forth, but whatever it is, it's a different area of understanding. But for the Western man, this dice faculty, which is this inner intuitive type level, is a big problem. So let's do our best to try to get a handle. We cannot get it in one discussion, but many, many hours of working on it will yield definite results, and it's the most important thing. There's no more important thing in life than to get a handle on this. So let's talk a little bit more about it. Where does a person grasp his own existence? In other words, I cannot prove it to myself because I can't use the external faculty. But the definition of the diet is that that's the organ, that's the sense organ, the knowledge organ that grasps my own existence. There are many other things too, which I hope we'll get time to talk about. But we're starting with one classical example. My own existence is grasped by me by a faculty that we call the diet. It's wordless, and therefore I can never grasp it in any way other than the fact that I know it. You follow? I know it because I know it. You follow? There's no way I can prove that I don't know it because of anything else. It's the root of knowledge. The mystics put it this way. Listen carefully to this. The mystics say that if you knew anything with a diet, and that thing turned out not to be true, you wouldn't exist. You would not be there. Because it's as real as your own existence. Because that's what it is. Let me give you they describe exercises which a person can use to get a personal feeling of this. It's not a feeling, it's a knowledge. But we can get to it through the emotions. Let me give you the following example. There is a time when everybody naturally experiences a very powerful voice of the dark. And that time is as follows. When a man is going through an experience of abject, total, blood-curdling terror, spine-chilling death, yeah, lethal terror. In that instant, if you can separate the emotion of fear out, we're not talking about the emotion of fear, if you can subtract the emotion of fear, what you experience in that moment is the knowledge of your own existence. I don't know if you've ever been, have you ever had an occasion when the plane begins to shake so badly that your eyeballs start to rattle? Really badly. And you get very, very afraid. When that happens, in that instant, suddenly a person, an amazing thing happens. All the things that were important to a person, they suddenly disappear. All the things that you thought were important before, they suddenly aren't there. The consciousness is filled with only one thing, don't let me die. Or my child can extend to that, extends beyond the self. But the prime feeling is, I must not die. Now, in that moment, nobody sits back and says to himself, well, wait a second, what am I getting worried about? Only last night I was sitting back in the armchair trying to figure out whether I exist or not. So what's the problem? I thought, probably not here. Maybe I'm here, maybe I'm not here. Let's tonight, since I'm terrified, let's go on the side that I'm not here. No, I'm worried. Discussions are impossible. And a person is in a moment of terror, there's a raw experience of life force, which is called the dark. I'm not talking about the emotion. There's a knowledge in the mind. You don't have any doubt about whether you exist when you're in terror. Is that clear? This is not enough to define it, but it's an exercise. There is one other time in life when we experience it. But when a person is sensitized, there are many occasions when it's felt clearly. I don't want to go into them. Most of them apply, much easier to relate to for married people. Some of them, there's other areas as well. But I'll tell you another classical place where it's felt. Another classical place is in the following situation. When you're under the waves, you're getting sucked under. Ever been in that situation? You dive under a breaker and you get sucked by an undertow and you can't take a breath and you cannot break surface. In that moment, as the consciousness starts to go, have you ever been in that situation? When you know you're about to go, that last feeling that a person has, not a feeling, that last consciousness is in the consciousness of the dive. But it's repeated again. When you break surface and take your first breath, that is a pure dive experience. At that moment, you don't need to be convinced whether you're here or not here. The consciousness is flooded with an awareness of your own existence. Let me tell you a very interesting thing. When Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, he did not mean that because I have electrochemical brain activity, which I define as thinking, that is a proof to me that I exist. Which is clear, isn't it clear? Because the fact that the cells of the brain operate in such a way that they produce what we call thinking is no different than using the battery. Physiological process with electrochemical activity, travel of impulses along nerves, no different at all than using the bathroom or eating. And using the bathroom is not a proof that you exist. So thinking, please, can you hold it? Thinking is not proof that you exist. That's not what he meant by God. He was not offering you thought as a better proof of existence. Of existence, not talking about a human existence as opposed to animals. Of raw existence as opposed to non-existence. He's not offering you thought as any more of a proof than using the bathroom or brushing your teeth or anything else. What Descartes meant was, I know that I am, therefore I am. But there's no way you can say those words. The dance cannot be expressed in words.
The other thing you can do is speak to an initiate. You can speak to somebody who's already initiated into a Galactic experience. And you can speak to a fellow initiate by saying that I think, you understand, which means I experience. You know, I have an inner consciousness. That's what he means. And therefore I know I exist. Because the one is the other. Is that clear? It couldn't mean anything. They're ridiculous. You follow? We give him credit. We give him, I don't know if you learned Torah, Descartes, but we give him credit that he's not suggesting that this physiology is any more meaningful than any other physiology. It's meaningless. Is that clear? What he means is that I have an inner experience, which is a proof of existence. It's not a proof of existence. It is existence. If it wouldn't be, I wouldn't be. Don't, somebody came up to me once after I tried to explain this and said to me, that doesn't prove anything. It doesn't prove anything. It's not a, this experience that we're talking about now, not a proof of anything. It's a level that doesn't need any proof. A person who's ever experienced it. You know, trying to explain this is very similar to trying to give somebody a skill. Have you ever had the experience of trying to share with somebody a skill? A knack, what you call a knack. In America, you call it a knack. Get the knack, the hang or something. When you try and convey that to somebody, there's no way you can do that. Because, let's say you want to show them how to hold that baseball bat, right? And how to get the action and hit that ball, or ride a bicycle. So you can tell him for weeks. And you can explain it to him, and you can explain what actions to do. And you can hold him and do it with him. And you can demonstrate. And you can show him a human skeleton and two movies, and whatever you want. But he won't give it. But you can bring him close enough that he gets it by accident. And as soon as he gets it, doesn't mean any words. You ever had that experience? By the way, that is a Dyson experience. The moment of realization is a Dyson experience. You follow that? That itself is a Dyson experience. That's one of the categories. It's one in the category of Dyson experiences. But the point is, and only then does he understand what you've been speaking about for the last 6 months. Now you've been talking to him for the last 6 months, didn't understand the word, couldn't get it. Now that he got it, he doesn't need any words, but he understands all the words. They're clear, right? I'm sure you've experienced that today. Now, I just want to point a direction from here. This element of inner knowledge. Of course, you can feel, if anybody's had this experience of, let's say, an awareness of learning. By the way, another definition of the Dao, if it is so simple that it's one of the reasons that it's inexpressible is that it's the definition of simplicity. The Geula, the redemption, is described as so posh. It means so simple. It follows so self-evident and simple that it can't even be expressed. The fact of one's own existence to somebody who has it is so fundamental. You follow? It's so basic that it's ridiculous to even make a question of. Somebody who has it would never. You follow? It's like the doubt when a person's learning to ride a bicycle, the tremendous doubt you will ever get it. The fact that thousands have done it before him is only an intellectual reassurance, but it doesn't help him at all at that moment. But the person who can ride a bicycle, the knowledge of how to ride a bicycle is not even in question. You follow? I mean, it's so poshit. Now, the doubt expands into a number of other areas. I don't want to go into them tonight, but I just want to mention them. The first and most important is that the doubt expands into a consciousness of the environment. Put more exactly, it's like this. That my das is my knowledge of my own existence, but it expands to a further knowledge. And that knowledge is that I exist in a context. I exist in another reality which is greater than me. That emotion, that going beyond the self into what's called context, is called emunah. That's called faith. It's the first step beyond the self. It's the first step in transcendence. It's the das which you're given as a gift, transcending into the first level of transcendence, yes? It's expanded all the way, which is a lifetime of work, into emunah, which means knowledge of God's existence. He doesn't mean belief. Judaism has no concept of belief in God. Did you know that? No concept. You don't believe. Because to believe in something that you can never know is pointless. So the next man believes in the opposite. Why are you better than him? He can't prove it either. And the next idiot believes in something different. You follow? It's totally meaningless. There's no concept of belief or faith, blind faith. Of course, all those words have got a meaning, else they wouldn't have stood the test of time. There is a point of anything, and that's another discussion we have to discuss sometime. But the common or garden use of words like blind faith and belief are useless and complete opposite of spiritual knowledge. You follow? You wake up one day and say, you believe. What you mean is you duped yourself, or somebody convinced you. You know what I mean? Judaism doesn't have that. You know. That's what you see. Knowledge. Das means knowledge, not belief. You don't work in learning Torah to convince yourself. Or blind yourself into some sort of brainwashed, mindless creature. That's not spiritual growth. And by the way, nobody who ever grew in that way would ever give his life for it. You follow? Nobody gives their life for that kind of thing. And we give our life for what we believe. But it's not because we believe it. It's because we know it. This is the beginning of that knowledge. But it cannot be known with the external object effect of it. Of course it can't. And you can never prove it to somebody else. Just like you can't prove your own existence, you cannot write down on a piece of paper. You can bring him very close, by the way. The external objective eye can deal with the concept of the transcendence in the world very effectively. Cannot tell you what it is, but it can force upon your consciousness that there must be one. That it can do. But what it is, you cannot know. Something of what it is, the eye can know. But it takes a lifetime of training. That's called the mind. That's called the work of the mind. Now, some other simpler areas that the eye deals with, and I think you'll be able to feel some of this, is, for example, some aspects of the concept of the finite and the infinite. That is also a tension between the das and the external eye. I'll give you a simple example. You know, Miller from Gate City, he used to say that he had the following experience as a child. He said that he used to lie on his back and look up at the sky. And this is a simple example. It's a child example, but it puts into very clear perspective the two poles of the das and the external. The Mabat Chitzer Tzvi. He said he used to lie on his back and look up at the sky. He used to say to himself, where does it end? And he used to say to himself, this was the experience that he had. He used to say, of course it doesn't end. It's not something that it ends. Because wherever it ends, there must be something beyond that. Of course it doesn't. It goes on forever. And he would say to himself, but it's got to end someplace. There's a finite world, right? I mean, everything's got to you can't have endlessness. It must have an ending. Of course it has an ending. Then he'd say, oh, then he'd say, but wait a second, what's beyond that? Of course, there's more beyond. So, of course it doesn't end. Then he'd say, but what do you mean? It's got to end. He says, what do you mean? And it's oscillating in this tremendous tension between a comfortable feeling. The tension there is an oscillation between the number of chitzoni and the number of pnimi. The number of chitzoni always grasps things in definition, in terms of boundaries. It has to be that way. That's the binah. That's the object of external faculty. But the das doesn't have any problem with a concept that doesn't have limitations. You follow? So the das is quite happy to grasp something that goes on forever. But then the Mamad al-Khitani speaks up. And there's a tremendous tension between the two, unless you know that they're two separate faculties and you know where to apply them both. I'll give you another classical application. Another classical application is the concept of the present. The concept of the present can never be grasped or defined by the external objective faculty. You know that? I don't know if you know, but that's a classical problem in physics, in mathematics, in theoretical and applied mathematics and physics. You cannot define the present. The best you can ever do is use a differential or integral function, right, which defines the present as that undefinable infinitesimal between the past and the future. Isn't that correct? Anybody studied physics knows that. But there's no way you can put the finger on the present. Which means that if you try and grasp your own existence in the present with the object of external mathematical I, you figure out that you don't exist. Because there's no time in which you exist. The past is gone. It's just a set of memories. And the future certainly doesn't exist. And the interface between them is infinitely small, so where are you? It's a tremendous problem. It cannot be defined in physics. It cannot even be annotated in physics, except by an integral function, which is really just skirting the problem. It's just like... But the das has a healthy knowledge of what the present is. It's now! You follow? The das doesn't struggle with that. The das knows exactly what it means. It's not bothered by the objective. You get... And a person can have a tremendous problem. If you're a mathematician and a physicist, you know what the present means. It's now while you're working on the problem. You know exactly what it means. But you try and define it objectively to another mathematician, you're in big trouble. Big trouble. You follow? That's another classical example of oscillation between the external and internal faculty. I'll give you just one more, and this is what we've been driving at. You know, is anybody with me? The experience of using your free choice is a dark experience. When a person makes a free will decision, the decision is made, listen, very, you have to hear very well here, the tools of the decision of the external faculty. That means you analyze and decide. Clear? You analyze, decide, what are the issues, get them clear, make a weighted reading of each factor, put it together, and make a decision. But the point of decision, the moment of the action of coming down on one side of the decision is a dias function. Put more clearly, it's this. This is much easier to get a hold of. The knowledge that you made a decision can only be grasped with the dias. Let me give you an example to explain what I mean. I think we discussed this, no? to some extent. If a person agonizes over a decision and makes a decision, imagine that his friend walks up to him and says like this. Imagine you're trying to make a major life decision. And you agonize and sweat and you make a decision. Your friend walks up to you and says, what did you decide? You say, I decided this. It was a hard decision, but I decided. The guy says, you poor idiot. You didn't decide. You're just a conglomeration of instincts. That's all you are. You're a genetic, a bundle of genes and conditioning. So you just acted out your genetic and environmental conditioning, that's all. Only you've evolved to the point where you think you decided. But that's an instinct. You follow? And if I would have known all the factors in the equation, I would have predicted your decision. And not only that, I would have predicted that you would have agonized for 33 and a half seconds. You follow? If I would have known exactly all your genetic makeup and every experience you've ever had in your life, you follow? And every of course it's impossible, but theoretically if I could, I would have known what you would, which means you didn't decide at all. Which means you didn't decide at all. There was no freedom in that decision at all. It was a forced move on the basis of your inputs. Yeah? Just like a worm moves towards the light or away from the light. So you're an evolved worm, that's all. You once were a worm, then you were lucky enough to be a chimpanzee, and now you descended to be a human, that's what they say. And as a human, you think you have free will, but it's got some survival value, and that's why you evolved it, but it's not free at all. You can never prove to such a man that you had a free decision. But you know it. Anybody with a dice that hasn't died completely, you know, any Westerner still has any of the dice alive, knows that when he made a decision, he made a decision. You follow? He might be an academic who then sits back and says, well, of course, it really wasn't actually a decision, because actually I'm just a bundle of reflexes. You follow? But at the moment of agony and making a decision, he relates to it as if it's true, because his dice tells him that he's making a decision. You follow? It's only the external object of I that then tells him that, of course, this isn't the real, because I believe in evolution, and therefore I'm just a bundle of conditioning. You follow? But the dice doesn't. The dice that insults the human intelligence to speak that way, and nobody made a decision. You follow? The intellect, the objective intellect fights with it. So, once again, this is an area where it's not worth trying to explain to somebody, because you'll never prove it to anybody, never be able to show it. Any dice function, as soon as you expose it, it shatters. As soon as you bring it breaks down and shatters. That's a part of the definition of the dice. You can never ever show anybody else that you have free will. Never. It's impossible. Only the dice can grasp it. Yes? One more thing. You notice that in the West, you cannot live without the dust. You can't live without the dust. But Western intellectualism denies that such a thing exists. That means I only work with an objective external mathematical faculty. That's what there is. Inner intuitions and mystical experiences and so forth, that's like for the Hindus, you know. I don't know about that. That's for the gurus. Maybe it exists. I'm not denying it, but I can't operate with it. That's what the Western attitude is. But any Westerner functions with a dust all the time. He doesn't doubt his own existence seriously. You follow? Else he wouldn't. He doesn't doubt that he's making decisions, as he wouldn't bother to make decisions. He talks that way. And by the way, there are other aspects of the dice that are more peripheral that you'll see that the West deals with exactly the same way. I'll give you one classical application. It's a very peripheral application, but you'll see that if you examine it, you'll find it's true. The knowledge that a human being is a human being, and not a bundle of conditioning that evolved out of a monkey. The very deep-seated knowledge of the dice. And Bhavinder Munna has got a nice, beautiful illustration of this point. Beautiful illustration. I mean, it's funny, but... Beautiful illustration. It gives the following scenario. Picture to yourself, it's bitterly funny, this. Suppose you ever had the experience of being at university, let's say. There's a guy at university, and he's writing a biology exam. Now, this is another example, I'm just giving you a way to think about it. Here's a person writing his exam, and he cheats. He cribs. You call it cribbing in America? Mm-hmm. He cribs from the guy next door, and he writes down his answers. And they discover him. So they call him in front of the professor and they say to him, listen, you're expelled from the university for disgracing the name of the university. You're a dishonor to the college and you're a dishonorable discharge and we'll never have you back here, the whole business, right? So the guy says, but one second, survival of the fittest. You told me that I'm just an evolved organism and I'm just trying to survive here. So I'm using his answers because that's the way to pass the exam. What's the problem? Now, if the professor says to you the following thing, We are failing you and expelling you because the point of an exam is to see what you know. If you write down the other man's answers, we contest what you know. You're defeating the point of the exam and so we fail you. But he doesn't say that. He starts talking about honor and integrity and honesty and dishonesty. Those are only meaningful if you have any concept of the dust, because it's only in the transcendence that there's any meaning to those things. A worm doesn't have honesty and honor and dishonesty and dishonor and all that kind of stuff, integrity. And if a worm doesn't have it, then a gorilla doesn't have it. And if a man evolved from a gorilla, he doesn't have it either. You don't evolve truth. You follow? If you change from a chimpanzee to a man who has a concept of truth, it's just a figment of your imagination. You can't evolve truth. Truth is an absolute. It's outside of you. Is that clear? So the professor has got no right to talk to you about dishonor and integrity and all that stuff. That's meaningless. That's rubbish. You don't speak to a baboon that way. And if you're just going to evolve baboon, it's meaningless for you too. But the university professor feels it very strongly. Because he has an intimate, intuitive mindset. There's a thing called dishonor, and it's not right, and it's dishonorable, it's not integrity, and you failed as a human being. There's an innate sense in this. Of course they'll see the paradox. If you put this to an academic, as I have a number of times, of course they see the paradox. But the intellect gets the better of them, unfortunately. But my victim has got a beautiful example. He says that, what's next to Holland? Cornell?
Columbia.
The guy finds the New York Cops and he says, down next to Holland over there, they're cutting up a man. They got him strapped to a table and they're cutting him up while he's alive. So the cops scream down to this place, they run into this address, they burst into the room, and they're strapped down to the table as part of an anatomy dissection room at Columbia, and they're dissecting a gorilla. So the cops say, what's going on here? There's a gorilla. You tell it. So the student says, no, I called you because he's my first cousin. I'm a first cousin from a gorilla, which means that if you can cut him up, you can cut me up. What right have you got to cut him up? Just because he's dumb and he can't speak. You've got no right to cut him up. So make up your mind. Either you've got no right to cut him up because he's a dumb animal who's my first cousin, or if you have got a right to cut him up, you've got a right to cut me up, and that's crazy. Well, the cop spits on the floor and he walks out, because the cop's a cop. Mm-hmm. He knows a man's a man, a monkey's a monkey. It doesn't bother him. Do you understand? There's a healthy... But the professor has to think about it. Because fucker, what's the difference? You follow? It must be. It's quite right. The objective problem is an objective problem. You follow? So I'm trying to show that there are many areas where the dice operate. And we cannot function without it. You're not human without it. There's no transcendent concepts without it. There's no truth, justice, duty, nobility, honesty, integrity. There's no yusuri in yeshiva. There's no learning. There's no love. There's no marriage. There's nothing without it. There's no sense of my own existence without it. There's no imuna. There's no belief. There's nothing without the dice. But in the West, we've been so trained out of even admitting that there is such a thing, that even now that we're discussing it, you're all suspicious. Mm-hmm. Yes? And until a person has done the homework exercise for many years, or hours and hours, and fallen into it and experienced it, you follow? And not regard it as a cop-out. Well, I must exist because I have some sort of awareness. It's not that. It's a knowledge. It's a pure, pure knowledge. Until that time, it doesn't exist for us in the West. Now, this will lead to tomorrow in many other aspects. Dice also means marriage. Why? Why is it marriage? Dice means procreation. A child only gets dice at age 13. Yes, a 12-year-old doesn't have dice. It has, you have to be 13 to have it. Pubic hair. You need pubic hair to have dice. Hair. Hair goes together with an element of the dice. What's the growth of hair mean? Why anatomically do we have hair? Why is there hair on the body at points of the root of organs of effect? You know that? Hair grows at the root of organs of hashpo in the world, like the root of the arms. The arm, the hand, is a man's organ of action in the world. At the root of the arm is hair. Right? The male is more hairy than the female because he's a given, she's a receiver. We have to discuss this. What's this got to do with the dice? Many, many other elements of the dice. Maybe I pull that up, and if people want to stay for 3 or 4 minutes, you can ask a few questions. Maybe. Somebody had a question.
Well, that's,
you know, if I have a doctor's experience at that point, then all I exist,
but once I prove myself that I exist, and I'm about to drown and break the surface, where I have to prove again.
You experience it again when you break surface, like we said.
Oh, that's right. The point is, once you prove that
you exist,
having a doctor's experience.
Once you've got in touch with it, you live forever with that knowledge.
Then you never have to prove to yourself.
Unless you're a skeptic. If you're the kind of skeptic who doubts that experience, and you need to go through it again, then you do. But if you contrain yourself, it's a very easy exercise. If a person gets a sharp grasp, a clear grasp of it at one time in their life, then a relatively easy exercise is to put yourself back in such a situation and you immediately click into it. You with me?
Right.
Some people can use the exercise of thinking about the present, or one or other example that I've used now, or when you next make a free choice decision. Use the experience of the free choice decision as a dice function, get in touch with it. There may endless examples of getting in touch with it. The truth is that people who work in this area and are working far beyond it, people who are working in Emunah, which is far transcending the self, are so aware of it all the time that it is their own existence. It certainly doesn't need anything. Do you follow?
How do you deal with the question of, well, is there actually an answer to that? Either one or the other?
You see, the dice isn't bothered by that, you understand? The dice cannot struggle with such a question.
But we're talking about objective truth also, aren't we?
That's not the dice.
Right. So how do we reconcile I understand you're saying it's two different parties that are coming up to different conclusions, but it still doesn't have to be an answer.
You see, the answer can only be got from the Tao. If I could answer you whether the universe has an end or not, whether infinity is a concept, if I could define infinity for you, only your Tao would understand
the
definition.
You say the Tao is correct and that's what the universe is different.
No, I didn't say that, not at all.
Okay.
But if I tell you that the universe is finite,
yeah,
you are immediately going to wonder about what's outside that finite boundary.
Okay.
Isn't that right?
That's the Tao.
And only the Tao can deal with it.
Okay.
Which means we can never talk about it. Yeah.
Okay. Second question was,
The Das has more than one function.
Okay.
But the mystics put it this way, that the Das, Hadas Machras, which means the Das is not only your grasp of your own existence, it's also the tool that axes down on one limb of a decision. The organ that chooses is called the Das. The assessing organ is the objective outside faculty. It weighs up the sides and sees a clear picture. But the organ that comes down on this side is another function of the Das. The Das Machras in that way. If you really want to know, the Das is made up of two faculties. It's made up of a faculty that splits and a faculty that bonds. Yet, women have a much stronger faculty of bonding. Women have a much stronger Das than men do in bonding. Men have a much stronger Das than women do in separation. You find many women that are the opposite, because everybody's a complex intermixing of both of them. You follow? But femaleness, the ultimate picture of femaleness in the universe, is a tremendous power of bonding, of receiving and holding and bonding. The ultimate pole of maleness in the world is a very strong ability to split almost identical units and separate. Yes? He also has the other one too. Women, by the way, many women, typical women, not only females, not only the female concept, but many women have, practically speaking, such a well-founded and strong bond, that knowledge of bonding, that they cannot be entirely objective. Did you know that? Because she bonds so strongly with the situation that she is that situation. It's one of the reasons that a woman's not allowed to be a witness. You know, a woman cannot be a witness in Jewish law. Not because she's feeble-minded. I know a lot of women that are a lot more brainy than most men, I know. A lot more objective. But a woman has a special gift. That she bonds to a situation so strongly that she's part of that situation. If you've ever seen a well-developed woman, she describes to you a scene that she witnessed, she might cry. She's there, she describes it, she saw a child fall and get hurt and so forth. It's her child, she's there, she's in that situation. And for being a witness, it's a wonderful characteristic that a man can never aspire to have that gift. But it's not good for a witness. For a witness, we want you to be able to divorce from the situation. That's not a woman's strength. It's another story.
It's obviously, as you're saying, besides that man can never even acknowledge his own existence and he can't acknowledge God's existence. And therefore, as it seems to me, you're saying belief has no role in Judaism. What do you mean by knowledge of God then? If you can't prove it.
What do we mean by knowledge of your existence? If you can't prove.
What do we mean by it?
Yes. You can't prove to me that you're using it. Fine. As soon as you're ready, I'm just. Yeah? Right now? You'll tell me? 2 more minutes? Listen carefully. You cannot prove to me that you exist.
Right.
You can't prove to me that God exists.
Right.
There's neat ways to get very close to it, by the way,
right,
which make it so convincing that it's worth spending the rest of your life that way on the chance that it's correct. But they're proofs by exclusion, they're not proofs by derivation.
Not 100%.
Well, they are 100% proofs, but they're proofs by exclusion.
Okay.
Proof by exclusion makes no contact with the personality. Yes, you can never prove God by derivation, because you'd have to be Him to do that. But you can prove that anything else is absurd, or close to impossible, or statistically not worth betting on.
Right.
You can do that, objectively, with the external faculty alone.
So that's what you call
analysis? No! That's a puerile exercise. That's just the beginning to get involved. It's just to make it worthwhile thinking about. But there's an experience, a knowledge, a deep personal knowledge, the same as a person's awareness that he exists. Now, you never can prove that to me. But you know it.
After the same doubt that says I exist, says God exists.
And that's why it's worth giving your life for. Because it is your life. It's at least as meaningful as your life. Much, much more than that. You follow? And the healthy doubt is an ethnic thing. It's a national thing. Millions and millions of Jews burnt and were tortured to death. Not because they were convinced or brainwashed into a martyr's kind of hypnotic state. That they had a healthy bias, a knowledge of that, just as well as their own existence. That this wasn't worth. They would rather they chose to be tortured to death. You know the Spanish Inquisition killed Jews? You know how they killed them? They cut their soles, cut the soles of their feet, put butter in the cuts, and roasted their feet over a fire. That was called the bastinado. And they took it. And died, burnt, roasted to death. Rather than kiss the guy's cross, kiss his cross and go home. What do you want, pretend? You don't do that because you've been bamboozled into some kind of hypnotic state. You do that because you know.
So then by studying Torah, you develop doubt?
Torah develops two elements. The Gemara, on the surface, develops the objective external faculty. It's a very analytical exercise. Develops the Bina. The Bina is the external analytical faculty. Separate, sort out. By the way, women don't learn. I heard the discussion before this one. But at a deeper level, if women don't learn Gemara, because they don't need to develop this faculty. Woman's strength is not in this area. A man needs. Woman doesn't drink Havdalah wine, you know that? When you make Havdalah, the woman doesn't drink a wine. Because Havdalah is the process of separation. A woman, we don't want to strengthen that faculty. A woman wants to strengthen the faculty of bonding. Just understand, there's nothing feminist about it, or anti-feminist. Each one is, there's no comparison. Each one is much more beautiful than the other one in its strength. But a man develops the analytical faculty, that's Gemara. But Gemara has many, many levels below the surface which are developing the Das. And swimming under the surface, as you come to, especially Agarisa, which is the mystical dimension, as a person comes to study those, the words are talking one thing, but below the surface, he's swimming at a depth that's inexpressible. And as you get in touch with that depth, the Das opens up and you're a completely new person.
Oh, okay.
It's a long story. It's a long story.
Remember, we began this series by talking about some of the elements in the Neshama, right, which make up. We spoke about certain elements which form a pattern, which build a mind. Remember? Something very high for Gotham, something on the right hand side, whatever that means, for Kafma, and the Neshama. Something on the left, Pima, whatever that is, or Bina. That's how the whole thing develops. Now, another issue we can look at on the same axis, which I think is worthwhile because it's also part of the power. It's part of the power struggle involved in making decisions and exercising free choice. It's part of the Das, which is that axis which is what makes us human, which we try to discuss a bit most now. And it's also a very powerful issue and like a sense of most things. Now, the root of this is like, we're going to. Yeah, so hold on there, okay? Hold you, okay, say you can go, hold foot. Yeah, that means hold your head on. Hold your head. It means like this. We're talking now about a root of something in the mind. But before that, we're going to talk about the root of this thing. Okay? Hold with me and you'll see how it develops. There is an issue which runs through everything that we've been discussing, which is an issue of duality or polarity. Which means that according to the spiritual concept, everything in the universe can be expressed as a meeting of two opposite forces, right? And it's the investing of one by the other, which is what creates any reality. The most general way to say it is male and female. But you can talk about right and left. Many, many different applications. I mean, it's one of the most, the foundation of the world. We mentioned an aspect of this, which is that the male dimension is a inspirational or creative dimension, and the female is that end of the pole or tension which takes the force that the male generates and then builds it into a concrete reality. Remember, we discussed that element. Let's look a bit more closely at that issue and see where it has its application in the mind. So the sages, especially later authorities, express it something like this. That in abstraction, you can look at this issue of male and female, you can express it in a very compressed and accurate way. You can talk about the following thing. Now the basis, the beginning of this thing, is what they talk about, that the world is made up of vessels, with life inside. This is in the deeper tradition, standards, words used. That means that anything that exists has two dimensions. It has what's called a kli. The kli means the tool, or the vessel. And inside the vessel you have a light shining. Now, I'm sure aware from a few discussions that we've had, that that's an impossible oversimplification, because the light itself is a vessel which has a light inside it. And the vessel is a light, too, which is shining inside an even more earthy vessel. Isn't that, you follow? But we just pick an abstraction at any point of this infinite chain in order to get the concept. Yes? It's clear? So the answer to this, you really want to know, is a life inside a life inside a life inside a life, and so on, and it's not, that's our business. But if we freeze it at any frame, then we see a duality between a life and a business. A simple, let me try and express it in its root of abstraction, in something we're familiar with. And then you can maybe get a handle on it. They put it a way they put it is like this. Anything in the physical world is made up of two elements. The classical expression of this is like this. The elements are called Chomer and Tzura. Chomer means material, or mass, and Tzura means form. So that anything you can think about has body or mass, and then it has form. Now, we can use this model to define some of its essential characteristics about elements. First fact is that one can never exist without the other. Translated, that means nothing can exist in the world unless it has mass and form, or unless it has a vessel and a life that's keeping it alive or in existence, right? Or unless it has a mother and a father. That's the way the mystics put it. Nothing can exist without a mother and a father. It means you need the male and female elements to give birth to a thing. And so forth. Look for a moment at the issue of Chomer and Tzura, of mass and shape. You will see immediately that it's not possible to conceive of anything that has one without the other. You cannot conceive of material without any shape. So it can't exist in the world. I mean, not only can it not exist, you can't even conceptualize such a thing. Even the most shapeless love of matter, it's got some shape, even if it's just a lump, but that's the shape. You can't have material without a shape. In conversely, you can't have a shape without matter. Because at least a line, what do you have, a triangle? At least you need lines to, do you mind holding the question for a while? You need at least elements that build a shape, even if it's an infinitely thin line, but you need something to find, you need some material, no matter how abstracted and refined, but something that's coarser than the idea for the idea to express itself. What's the difference? That's also the same duality. Like I said, the life's got a life inside it that keeps it real, keeps it alive, keeps it there. And that life got another life inside it. So forth. The human has got a body, and then it's got something inside that body which is its animation, which is its life force. But that's got something inside of it which is keeping it alive. The soul has a soul, and that soul has a soul. And the soul of the soul of the soul of the soul, if you can keep going infinitely, is what's called Hashem. It's called the life of the world. And as well, in the deeper tradition, the chain is followed in great detail. You can pick it at any level and see what are the duality at that level. For example, with the Rambam talks about angels. Angels are meaningless word in English. In English, it's that child of reason, in fact, it shouldn't be more ridiculous, is it? But a malach in Hebrew is some kind of transcendent emanation of force, whatever that means. A malach is a creature that has some, although his physical, his existence, his kli, his vessel is not physical at all. He's completely transcendent. He doesn't have anything physical about him. But he has a kli. His vessel is something that's very abstracted and ethereal compared to the physical world, but it's there. Inside of that vessel he has a life which keeps him alive, keeps him together. It's even more ethereal. And then there's a creature higher than him, and a creature and so forth. Yeah. Now, but the place to conceptualize it, since we are creatures of this world, is to begin by considering matter and form. And many rules become apparent. The first rule is, again, one cannot exist without the other. Is that clear? Not even in the mind. Two, the form imposes itself on the matter, and not vice versa. It's the form that defines the matter. Is that clear? It means the matter takes the shape that the form defines. That's definitional. I mean, it's not even subject to. And there are many other aspects that you can focus on in this duality. But what I want to do now is I want to look at one of these patterns that it happens in the mind, which will illustrate this idea, and also I have given us some practical application. So now we're going to descend a little bit into a more practical area. The duality that we focus on in this thing is called intelligence, intellect, and imagination. The intellect is the male controlling form, and the imagination is the matter. Now, this is this duality itself in the mind has many levels, and it goes to the imagination has more than one level, and the intellect has a whole complicated. But we're going to abstract it now into just one simple plane. If we're going to take one sliver here, just to examine. Now, you've seen amazing things in this paragraph, okay? This is important. From here on in, the first, up to now, it's introduction, doesn't matter to you, forget it. From now on in, it's the practical application. Now, you'll understand readily anybody who was here yesterday, 2 days before, that we're talking about the das now. We're talking about a das function, and we're talking about the theory, big choice, yes? But we're not going to refer to those terms. We're just going to take this particular model and try and explain it with it. See that the intellect is a. It's a thing which doesn't have any matter. In other words, it is a process. It's just process. It doesn't have any picture or symbol. It's a method of processing. It's logic, for example. What is logic? Logic doesn't have any symbols. Logic needs symbols to work with, but it doesn't. It does, by definition, doesn't have any symbols. Logic is a process. Yeah? It's the hardware of the computer before it's even switched on. I mean, you need all those circuits and channels in potential to do any work. But you don't have any output yet, or any input. Imagination is the matter. It's the symbol. It's the material. It's no process at all. An A and a B and a C, or a 1 and a 2 and a 3 that you feed into the computer, the meaningless, those things can't do anything. It's only the process of the computer that takes those symbols and bashes them into some kind of shape and gets some kind of meaning out of them. Now, let's check if it fits the definition that you said. The process controls the symbols. True? The symbol don't control the process, you don't have this way that the person sees. It can never exist one without the other. Intellect can never function without symbol. How can intellect function without some kind of symbol? Imagine trying to do mathematics in your mind without any symbol. It's impossible. What?
Okay. There's actually the other hypothesis that we'll do without symbol.
We hope to get there as well, but we're trying to build more of the basis of it. Real spiritual growth is in a point where there can be no secret. That's what Kabbalistic wisdom deals with. That's why it's a secret. Kabbalistic wisdom is a secret not because they don't want you to know about it. The definition in part of a secret is not something. In the secular world, the definition of a secret is something that you can hear yet. When you hear about it, it won't be a secret. So that's the six-year-old thing. That's not a secret. They just didn't tell me. If only they would tell me. That's not a secret. Kabbalistically, a secret is something that you cannot be told because it can't be said. That's why it's a secret. You follow? That's why no one ever told you. Not because they didn't want to tell you, but they can't. It can't be put into words. That's why the Mishnah says that. That's why the Mishnah says that the deepest Kabbalistic secrets, Masim HaKavah, Masim HaRashi, things like that, the Rebbe is allowed to teach the Talmud only on condition that it's one-on-one. Only, and even then it says he's not allowed to teach him the details. He can only teach him the chapter, the main categories. You follow? The broad outline. And the student has to fill in the details. So it's some kind of a game. It's not some kind of a game. The point is that the Rebbe can't tell you the details because there are no words for those things. That thing is in only point of direction, like a discussion of the night. But the Talmud's got to figure it out by himself because otherwise there's no way to get it. That's why the secret will always be a secret. That's what sort means. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah,
so what? Again? It just doesn't exist in symbols. It cannot be put into conversation. It can't be written down. Now, that will get a chance to discuss this. Now, the intellect controls the imagination, and it uses it. What the intellect does is, it uses symbols in order to operate on. Yes, it takes the symbol and it controls them to get to an end result. Now, there's a problem now. But the problem is this, that intellect and imagination are opposite poles in many other things. Let me give an example. Intellect requires tremendous energy input. It never works by itself. It's not free running, it's not self-generating. Pure intellect, that means pure mathematical type logic, right? Only works when you concentrate hard and work at it, when you push one step to the next, to the next, to the next. Every single movement in that field takes energy input. When you sit back in an armchair and relax, the intellect never functions, the imagination starts going crazy. But the intellect doesn't work at all. intellect only works with intense concentration and directed effort and energy input from one step to the next. As soon as you lose control for a second, imagination wipes you out. Imagination, on the other hand, the lower element, requires no energy input at all. It runs wild by itself. It doesn't require any, on the contrary, it requires to be damped down and controlled. It's a tremendous machine, tremendous source of energy, runs by itself. Which is where all the problems begin. Because the process that happens is this. You start thinking about something, and 2 seconds later, you find you're in Hong Kong. Usually it happens when you're trying to dive, or when you're really trying to be serious and concentrate, right? You start concentrating about something. What happens is, and of course you realize that these two elements have nothing of each other. The dinyon, which is imagination, has nothing of the sacred. It has no logic at all. Absolutely no logic. Which means, listen very carefully to this. It means it's a very, very powerful animal with absolutely no control. Totally out of control. And if you think about it, this is the way it works. You stand and you begin to say shmoneser, right? You're concentrating hard on you, this is for this time, for sure you're going to say all 19 brothers which you never cover on, right? By the time you get to the third or fourth word, you're suddenly taking a trip somewhere in Hong Kong, and how did you get there? You know you got there? The first word you said triggered a memory. By some chance, peripheral association, the memory triggered a smell. The smell reminded you of something else. Some peripheral aspect of that picture shot you someplace else. And within 3 or 4 seconds, you manage across the world with no loss. Sometimes it's so embarrassing you don't remember where you started. Sometimes you haven't had that experience, you don't remember what you started out to think about. That's how it is. You're so powerful that they say that a great man is a man who can concentrate on the same thing for 3 minutes. If you can think about one subject intently for three minutes, unbroken, you are on your way to greatness. You're almost impossible. There's a deep mythical reason why it's impossible, and you'll be able to get there as well. But the point is that's how it works. Now, everybody with me so far? Now, which means that the ideally balanced human being is a man who is able to maintain control of his intellect over his imagination. That means he's able to ride that animal, you follow, he's able to ride that machine, that animal, in such a way that he doesn't damp its energy, but he uses the energy. And a great horseman, with a small nudge of control, can get that animal to go exactly where he wants it. Which means that he allows the imagination to throw up enough symbols for him to work on, but only enough to work on, and never more than what he needs. A great mathematician is thinking through a problem, right? So as he thinks through the logic of the problem, he uses enough symbols to give shape to the idea, and he goes from that step to the next, to the next, to the next, but he never allows any outside association to come in. He would never let the sound of the word three trigger some other association, and from there he starts thinking about lunch, and from lunch he starts thinking about this, and then he gets lost that way, right? By the way, that's what happens. That is exactly what happens. But a man who's in complete control can get from the beginning of the Shmoneh Esrei to the end of the Shmoneh Esrei, which is almost impossible, right, without taking a world trip. And that's why, by the way, the halacha is that when you're davening Shmoneh Esrei, the minimal obligation is an amazing thing. The halacha is that you have to have intense concentration for what the words mean for only the first bracha. Imagine this. You're standing talking to Hashem, right? 3 times a day. You stand up. You're now going to talk to the creator of the world, which means you're on the Shema. To the highest point of your neshama, and words connected to the infinite. That's what you're about to do. Not much could be more important than that, right? And you start, and you're going to have intense, having a conversation with the creator of the world, right? And all it requires is that you mean what you say for the first bracha. The other 18, you can travel all over the world. You can just run on automatic, which is what happens. You vomit out the words, right? You pull out the words on automatic, and you don't mean a word you say. You don't even know what you said. And you find suddenly you've taken 3 steps back. You don't know what happened. That's how it works. All you require to do is the first bracha of intent. You know why? Because it's almost impossible to do more than it takes tremendous training, tremendous effort of muscle, self-control, to be able to maintain control of the intellect over the imagination. Imagination is so powerful. By the way, many marriages you see this problem. I'm not talking now about men and women. We're talking about the abstraction of male and female. Okay? I'm not talking here about a woman who's got a great imagination and a man who's too logical. It can be the opposite. We're not talking about that. But the ideal thing called the zivug, that is, where the one controls the other, is a perfect match where the logic, the method, the process, is allowing only enough images to be raised to do the job and none to get out of control. The problem, as I said, the effort of self-control is because the intellect requires tremendous work to keep moving, and the imagination runs away with you without any energy input at all. Now,
this duality can be used in many other ways. A great artist, for example, a great creative artist, has learned the trick of letting his imagination run wild. That's a very, very powerful thing, and he's just maintaining enough direction, just riding that animal, just skilled enough to maintain it in the direction that he wants, so he gets a unity. You can't produce free use of imagination, literally complete free use of imagination, will not produce art. It will produce havoc. You follow? Because it's got absolutely no logic to it. So you have a chance association spinning off to all kinds of things, which is just, if you ever read, let's say, Stream of Consciousness, even somebody who's involved in literature, Joyce, let's say, you read anything to do that's based on Stream of Consciousness, it's very much in use of imagination, it's very controlled, and there's nothing crazy over there. Somebody who's going through Stream of Consciousness, you wouldn't make any sense of it because there is no sense to it. It's complete chance peripheral associations that don't make any sense at all. It's purely subjective experience. So you learn the trick of letting it use its full force. That's a very difficult trick to learn. To let your imagination run full force and yet keep it directed. Yes? More common and more useful for most people in most places that I like is to not let it run full force at all, but to keep it completely damped and let only the intellect work, which requires tremendous energy input, and let the imagination only give enough symbols that control is maintained. That's a perfect marriage. It's a perfect marriage between intellect and emotion, between intellect and imagination. Any questions after this point? Yeah. Suggestive? You mean you find that you discover silly patterns, is that what you mean? Aren't you working with direction and intelligence? Aren't you looking and searching and researching with intellect and direction? If the imagination puts any control in, then you're of course in. As soon as the symbols define what the process is going to be, you're out of control. The mathematician wants to work out a certain problem, but the 3 and the 4 and the A and the B and the C are telling him what to do, he's out of control. You follow? The machine's running, but you lost the steering. Right? Imagination is the V8 under the hood. And intellect is the steering mechanism and the brakes, too. Yeah. Of course you can't live without her. You can't live without her. That's a very good question. So you have a number of questions in there. Very good questions. Yes, so you remember. Your first question is, where does the energy come from? How do you move from one step to the next? That's free will exercise. That is raw thing. That's called the fear. That's the willpower of the God. That is your will. It is your willpower. If you don't use it, you won't get from step A to step B. No mathematician ever went from step A to step B to step 3 in a complex series of logical deductions by sitting back in his armchair and letting his imagination operate. It was just tremendous energy input all the time. That energy comes from the will. You know what the will is, according to the mystics? The forehead. You know why? Because it's where you face. You have to, you follow? You have to set the direction. That means you have to move. You have to face in that direction. It's interesting. The forehead's got no organ at all. It's just direction. It's just the way you're facing. That's what it is. The second question you asked was, how do you know which is the next step? Now, that is a complex subject, and that is a function of the intellect. It might be by deduction, it might be by experience, it might be by a pure act of inspiration, which is an opening up of the dark to its highest element and letting something new come in. The mystics say that concentration is not focusing on anything. You can't do that. Concentration is wiping everything else out. Concentration means expelling anything extraneous from the mind so that the thing you want can fall in, but you can't bring it in by yourself. You can't generate something from that. You mentioned this before. That's why in Yiddish an idea is called an Einfall. Einfall means something that falls in. Well, you can't put it in. Where are you going to put it in from? From outside of yourself, you can't do that. But you can clear the obstruction so that it can come in from the source which transcends you. We're not talking about that at all. Not at all. We're talking about the field of the mind that handles symbols, words, pictures. You with me? That's all. The physical matter of thought. The process is the intellect. The images are the imagination. The imagination just happens to be given to culture because it doesn't have any intelligence. But it's not by definition false. The imagination is what holds in your mind symbols or letters. Let me explain to you a bit more carefully. The way we look now is so low. our inner life is so low that we cannot function without the coarsest and crudest of symbols. Do you know how we think? We have a sagrada with ourselves. That's how you think. I don't mean to offend you, but that's how we think. It means you say something, then you run around and hear how it sounds and you answer back. Then you run back again and you respond. And that's what you do. You're carrying on a cumbersome conversation with yourself. These days, by the way, most people aren't even capable of doing that. All they do is see television pictures. You see the picture and you see the next picture. It's so graphic now, you follow. Television, by the way, is a symbol of very low society. I'm not talking about immorality. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about being exposed to the most explicitly graphic medium is a descent into the lowest level of human thought. It's a level of working with the images all the time. You follow? It's complete damping of the intellect which is maintaining control. You've been fed images all the time. There's nothing wrong with images. When you experience the world, you're also seeing images. No question about it. But television is so operated that the whole process is done for you. That's why the greats object to children watching television. Even if it would be moral. I'm not talking about what they show them on television, not to ruin anybody for life. I'm not talking about the fact that they show you moral things. The process itself is problematic. The process itself. Gemara doesn't have any pictures, you notice that? Very few pictures in Gemara. Because it wants to train the process. Very seldom. Sometimes an authority bring a diagram to make clear something that can't be said in words. The Gemara avoids that. The Gemara could have been much more simple. The Gemara Arabic could have been a series of pictures. When I was in the Kollel once, we were learning Arabic. Arabic is very, very diagrammatic, three-dimensional structures, right? It's like stereo structures and the whole spaces. And so I said to the Rosh Hashiva, I would like you to make a blackboard in the Kollel. I'll put up a blackboard on the wall, and when you give us a shear, you wouldn't have it. He says, no, that's not the way we do. Because that will take away from you. So, in other words, of course it's a valid teaching tool. If you're trying to deal with somebody you cannot conceptualize and you want to bring him to the level, of course you do that. Of course you do. 6-year-old needs pictures, you don't understand abstraction. But you want to, as soon as possible, get to the highest level of abstraction where you don't need to the courses and finish things. The real spiritual activity is beyond where they're sitting. This is what somebody was referring to. The real spiritual level, what's called Seichel HaYuni. Seichel HaYuni is a level of intellect that functions at a plane where there are no symbols or words. And that's when you start talking. The reason is that at that level, it's not possible to be wrong. Do you know this? You can only be wrong when you have symbols. Because words, symbols, tend to lie. But the process cannot be wrong. Listen carefully. The safer like union, in that level of the mind where there can be no symbols, in that level of the mind above pictures and images and words and symbols, there's only two possibilities. You either understand or you don't, but you can't be wrong. You follow? There's no shaker of it. It's not possible to have an untruth there. There's no it just can't be. You follow? It's a pure process. But you can't talk about that to anybody. I'll tell you a beautiful place where you know this. It says that let me give you an idea. See, Torah is an infinite thing. The physical universe is finite. Which means that Torah could never exist in the physical world. You can never put Torah into the world. How can you take Hashem's infinite wisdom and put it down in a few pages that cost 3 books? Impossible, right? As it happens, it is done. But that's because Hashem can do the impossible. But by nature it's impossible. A human being says it's impossible. Human being is a piece of cake. And inside the piece of cake is a neshama. That's impossible to understand. There's no way to understand it. That's the miracle of creation. It's the miracle of putting together two impossible and mutually exclusive opposites. That's why we call a human being a pele. Pele means a wonder. What doesn't mean a wonder. No. When we say that a human being is a wonder, we don't mean that he's fantastic, very complex. The fact that it's complex doesn't mean anything to Hashem. Hashem could have built the machine a lot more complex if he wants to. No, not to Hashem's complexity. That's not what's wonderful. What's wonderful is that it's a combination of two impossible opposites. That's a trick. To make a man more complex than me and you is not a trick for Hashem, I can assure you. And to make him a lot simpler is not a trick at all. But to put together two impossible and mutually exclusive opposites that zap each other out of existence instantaneously, that cannot possibly coexist, the finite and the infinite in one spot, that's totally impossible. That's untrue. That's called a pele. That's what a human being is. By the way, anything in the world is that. Anything with a tree, which you can find, with a light inside it, which is infinite, anything is like that. And in a human being, you come very close to seeing it. Of course, the faculty of the human being that demonstrates it specifically is speech. Because speech is the point of connection between the two opposites. In speech, you take an abstract idea, which has no physicality at all, and you put it out into sound. You put it in phrases with a physical organ in the physical world. By the way, that's why speech, the organ, the voice is produced by a very amazing part of the body, the neck. The neck is a piece that does nothing other than connect the transcendent level to the physical level. The neck is the connector. So voice is formed in the level where the connection happens between the two. Right? That's what happens. That's speech. That's why a human being is the only one to speak. Because he is the ultimate connector between two impossible opposites. Now, Torah is the dimension that can never be put into physicality. So Hashem's thought himself. The world is finite. Therefore, the two could never be things. Moses was unable to speak. You remember that? Moses couldn't speak properly. He had a speech, and he couldn't speak. So the anti-Semitic six-year-old teacher teaches the kindergarten class, she said that, you know, Moses had a speech impediment. You know, he stuttered. You know, I don't have to speak for him. There couldn't be anything more against Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu was a perfect human being. He was the most perfect human being ever. He had light shining from his face. He didn't have speech defects. Moses didn't have speech defects. Moses couldn't speak because where Moses was holding can't be said. It's not that he couldn't speak, he was above it. He wasn't below. It wasn't like, we could speak nothing that he couldn't speak. He was above human speech. He was functioning in a world where you can't say those things in words. A word is a limitation. A word is a clothing. It's a clothing of an idea. You can't put an infinite idea into words. As soon as you do that, even if the words are accurate, even if you choose the words correctly, but you've limited it now to just these words, you've taken an infinite thing and put it into the... Of course Moses couldn't speak. You follow? But it was his perfection. It wasn't his failing. After Torah was given, Moses spoke normally. You know this? He spoke perfectly normally after Torah was given. Because after the miracle had been brought into the world, of combining the impossible aspects, after the world, follow? After Torah, the infinite, had been put into the finite world, that problem was over. Moses could speak. What do you think it means when it says God came down on the mountain? What do you think it means Hashem came down on the mountain and all the Jews saw it? You know what it means. It means like it meant when he was 6 years old. So the man in the sky with a big white beard came down on the mountain and it was like fire and that's what you think. And you might not like to admit it, but that for sure is what you think. When it says that Hashem came down on the mountain, it's only a physical word because there are no other words to use. What do you want the Torah to say? To put an instruction that doesn't have words, what are you going to read? So translate into a 6-year-old's terms, which is all it is, and don't forget it's a 6-year-old that understands too. That's the brilliancy of Torah. 6-year-old understands it perfectly correctly, absolutely. But it's only 27, it's a different figure. When it's 27, it's another world. But it never contradicts what he understood as a 6-year-old. What it means Hashem came down on the mountain, what it means is that the infinite reached the finite. The infinite dimension came into contact with the finite. Impossible? You're darn right, but it happened. Yeah. That's what Torah means. And that's why it's possible to have a document today, which is a finite set of books, or a few pages, 200,000 letters, which is the document that you hold in your hand infinity. What's so wonderful about that? That's what you are. That human being is there. No, a human being is. A human being is a field that's finite with a tremendous, absolute, unlimited infinity within it. Anybody who's got two cells to rub together, who relates to a human being with any depth, can see that. You have to be a horse to relate to a person as a piece of meat. Which is, by the way, what the world is intended to. Not the world is living now like relating to horse meat. That's what it is. People get married for 50 years, they live together, they never see each other, and they have a piece of steak, that's all. But anybody who's got any sensitivity to human beings knows that when you sit opposite another human being and fall in love with that person, a friend of yours, or a woman that you fall in love with, anybody with any sensitivity knows not falling in love with a steak. Of course, you need it. You need the tissue, you need the body. You can't have another thing without that. You can't love a human being. You can't relate to it. You can't have children without that. It's very important. You're not selecting the body over here. But that's not what you love about the person. What you love is what's undefinable, what's inside. It's a completely transcendent thing. But today they've managed to reduce everything to, you know, to do the repeat of hospital, some instincts, you know. So you're like, It's an insult to human intelligence to it, it's ridiculous. It's such a beast, such an ugly thing. Any more questions? No, yes, that is yours, you know. Any other questions? I don't follow you. Are you asking me that I make this up?
No, I'm asking you if this is the model of
I'm telling you sources that come from Sana, like through Maya and Rebain, word for word, you can read this in the Maya with just these words, translated in the Hebrew.
So somebody else would be trying to.
If he's quoting the Maharal, then you'll say, We find in the Maharal the fact that Maharal was unable to speak and that it was an expression that he could speak afterwards. He's the one who popularized the concept called Chomer and Tura. The Maharal is the one, the Maharal of Prague, who lived in the 1600s, who created a human creature, he created a golem, right? He was able to do the trick himself. He said he couldn't speak. Okay, but it was still some trick, right? He himself, he was the one who explained this duality of Chomer and Tura, the life force of a light investing the Kli or the vessel. Yeah. First of all, as you said, diagrams can't be used. The person who's on the level of needing a diagram has to use a diagram. One of the reasons that Kabbalah is kept secret is because the man who uses the diagram and thinks that thing is so deathly lost that there's no hope for him at all. There's a danger, you follow? The deeper wisdom is expressed in such a way that we use physical terms in order to transmit an abstract. But if you see the physical term, you're lost immediately. Let me give an example. In the Kabbalistic writing, it says the following thing. When a person bows to Hashem, then you have to picture something, right? You have to have something in your mind. And yet it's forbidden to have anything. Because whatever you have in your mind is a death sentence for that. That's called Hakshama. To reduce Hashem to any definable thing, no matter how abstract, the death penalty. So what do you have when you daven? What's going on? You can't daven to nothingness. You can't speak to something that you're trying to make nothing. On the other hand, the Kabbalah talks about very striking pictures. Never mind the diagram of sense. It talks about words that are very, very, very graphic. And it's talking about attributes of Hashem in a world that we call UK Vaska. It's talking about elements of that world which are very, very graphic. What's going on? So in the Kabbalistic writings, especially in the last century, especially in the most recent, you'll find it most explicitly, to say the following thing, that for purposes of study, you can use those words, because you've got to, what else are you going to use? But of course we're trusting that the man who's qualified to study these things knows that he's dealing with an abstraction. He knows that when he uses this word or that word, that he doesn't dare have that picture. All he's doing is using a symbol for a meaning, which is quite a comfortable exercise. When you do algebra and use A, B, and C, you don't mean at, the, and kill it. You're using a symbol which is a pure abstraction to you. What you're doing in algebra is coming very close to using pure process. The symbol is a multi-potential element which you use, but without getting trapped into the symbol. That's how even 1 and 2 and 3 are symbols that don't trap you, but they're much more graphic. A, B, and C are much, much more abstract than 1, 2, and 3. And you manage it quite skillfully without thinking that you're dealing with an A. You realize you're dealing with a symbol that connotes something that's completely abstracted from the symbol. But when you've done into Hashem, there you're not even allowed to have those. So the advice they give is as follows. A person who doesn't know the details should just done into Hashem. That's Hashem. And one person who does know, which is called Kavonis, done into the man. To the name, and it's very specifically described exactly what name, how, which combination, and stuff, but nothing other than the name. They have Chassid Shalom in the picture. It's a tragedy. And that's why one of the main reasons that people are not allowed in the Kabbalah, because you can take a man and you put him in a lethal situation. Here's a man who was doing okay before, and now you give him some kind of thing. He thinks the picture's a thing. Even if he thinks he's abstracting an abstraction, 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 but he ends up with something, he just killed him. That's why I'm interested. You see, there's two points that need to be noted. One is that there's no missing point. We're describing here a theoretical polarity which is east and west, heaven and earth. There could be not, it's like relativity to male and female. We're two, listen. Male and female are two opposite things, you know. But if you want to know, there is a glue that joins them, and that glue is called the Das. That's what we discussed last night. The Das is a tool which the mystics express like this. They say that it's a structure which has a receiver on one side for the one element and a receiver on the other side for the other element. And it's nothing in itself, but it's a receptor and a receptor. The Maharal, if you want to reference again, the Maharal is the one who says that anything that joins two things must have some of each, or it could never bond with both. It's the glue in the middle. I'll just give you a hint that when man and female come together, when a man and woman get married, the das that bonds them, the glue, is called hamra, pleasure.
What is the Maharal?
What is what? You asked me for reference. He's the man who taught these ideas in these terms. Maharal, Mem Hei Reish Lamed, that's the initials of his name. From Prague. Yes.
When you were describing the marriage in the sense of the infinite with the finite, you were also implying the soul, the eternal with the body?
Yes.
Okay. So how, according to that, in Judaism, they have some kind of, they get along somehow. They're not totally opposed. So how is that possible?
It's a miracle. That's called Pele. The fact that there can be an infinite neshama from the source of reality in a piece of stack, that's a very, very finite and limited bag of excrement. That's what you are, if you'll excuse me. That lump of issue. The Gemara says that if a man's having trouble with a woman, the man is having trouble with thoughts about a woman, you should think to yourself that she's a bag of excrement with blood in her mouth. That's what the Gemara says. Think of a woman like a takes a lot of heat, I can assure you. So that's what you are. And inside of that is the source of the world, of infinity. That, you figure that one out. That's the central Kabbalistic mystery. How those two things could ever be. That's why when you come out of the bathroom, you say a monthly lasses. Monthly means pele. Pele means the most inexplicable, amazing thing. What are you thinking about? You just went to the bathroom. In Judaism, you make a blessing when you go to the bathroom, right? That's some religion, right? You go to the bathroom, you come out and you say, Hashem, thank you for food. What do you say? Monthly lasses. That you do amazing things. Just went to the bathroom. What's going on? You didn't come up with a new composition. You just went to the bathroom. Not be lost, because when that body operates, you see and hear a combination. You see a light shining inside a vessel that is. Let me just give you some ideas. The mystics put it like this. They say that the light that shines in the vessel is so powerful compared to the vessel. So powerful. I'll just give you two images of how powerful it is. One is this. It has to be limited. It has to be limited by so many shields in order to survive, for the body to survive with the neshama inside, the neshama has to be so dampened by so many nuclear lead shields that the amount of light that's left in us today is called the Havna Degarmi. You know what that means? Havna Degarmi means that we are as alive today as a pile of dried human bones. You follow? In terms of what human existence should have been. If you compare Adam with Adam as a human being, his existence as a human existence, I'm not talking about Hashem, talking about the human existence, was in proportion to our existence as humans, as a human, a living human being is to a pile of dried bones. We are as alive today, the life force that invests us, in reality, if you could see it from if you'd ever met Adam, if you were able to see Adam and Isha, and then you focused and looked at us, you'd see a pile of dried human bones. You follow? That's the only little speck we have left. The mystics say that it's just enough of a speck and a spark to keep us in existence. That's all. But that's all. Another way they say it is that we are the skin on the soles of the feet, this generation. That's how much life there is in us. Abraham was made in the heart or the brain. Right? Today, you're the thick skin on the soles of the feet. That's what the interest of the Mashiach means literally the soles of the feet of the Mashiach. That's what we are. We're the bottom of the structure. No place to go. You can always say that the soles of the feet are dead already. They don't rot after death because they're dead already. They don't feel anything except superficial stimulation. They're dead to all genuine emotions or feelings except tickling in this generation. Dead to anything serious, but ready for superficial thrills. That's what it is. Exactly that. What? Yes, because we're the bottom end. We're the mummish, the bottom end. We're stuck in the mud. We're the last. We're the last. We're the worst. We're the lowest. I'll give you one other image. Beautiful thing. Beautiful, beautiful thing. It's like this. If the light would shine in the body permanently, if the light would shine inside the vessel, the mystics put it this way. I don't want to go into detail, but I'll just tell you that the way it is that the light shines and then it leaves. And then it shines and then it leaves. Why? Because even that small amount of light that the vessel can hold, if it will shine permanently, it will shatter the vessel. Where do you sit? We'll end with this. You know why a human being sleeps? When you sleep, you know what happens? The higher elements of the neshama leave the body. You know why? Because if the neshama would shine in the body permanently, it would shatter the body. You would die. If you don't sleep, you die. If the neshama shines inside the body, you go crazy and die. You can't survive that way. Because the body is made in such a way, it can only take that light for a certain number of hours, and then it starts to fragment, and the life has to leave. And by the way, it's also the reason why you cannot concentrate on one thing without being distracted by the imagination. Because if you concentrate on one thing powerfully with no interruption, it shatters your brain. You follow? So you have to have the imagination coming in and wiping it out. And then it comes back to concentration and wipes it out. It comes back. Yes, and that's why the world is created with day and night, by the way. That's the meaning of night time. It means that there's a non-existence that comes to an existence. Non-existence and comes, but there could never be a... The next word it says will be a night time that is life. Will be a night and day both life. It doesn't need to go away to come back. This world is always a falling to rise. The tzaddik says that to fall seven times before you can be a tzaddik. It says that you only understand Divrei Torah through getting it wrong first. You know that? You can never understand a piece of Torah unless you got it wrong first. There's Ein Adam Oymer of Divrei Torah, and then can Nishol Bahim Tchila. Cannot understand Divrei Torah unless you got it wrong first. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
You can't. And only through coming through through wrong can you come. Let's go. Thank you.